George McCarthy, son of Mr. Jerry's, Clark Henry Forrest,
May it please the court, good morning. I am Timothy Shea. I'm here on behalf of the appellant Batul Haksari, who is with me in this courtroom, and on behalf of the class of United States citizens she represents, who were passed over by this federal agency when they were selecting aliens for positions at the Voice of America. I'd like to reserve, if I may, I have offered to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, so I think that leaves me at this moment with perhaps 5 minutes. The two points I'd like to address before you are, one, the heart and soul, to the extent this the government position has, may be said to have either, an exotic procedural gamble. And I don't think either of them are either legal or factually sustainable. First, with respect to the matter of exhaustion, there is some claim that Ms. Haksari failed to exhaust her remedies at the outset. And I'd like to point out a couple things. First, she filed a written complaint on January 19, 2005. And she had no response to that whatsoever until June of the same year, none at all. In between then, she had been fired. And there's some suggestion that somehow she had failed to exhaust remedies there, I think is really quite difficult to, although it is a centerpiece of the government case, I really think it's something that deserves some strong disapproval.
Are you saying that she used the CSRA procedure? No, this is a different exhaustion.
This is different exhaustion, and I will get to that, Your Honor, in just a moment.
You do have a claim that she used the CSRA?
Well, the answer is yes. First of all, she exhausted her remedies, and then she went to EEOC, and then she went to the district court. So she did everything that was available to her at the time. So I think that's very straightforward. The contention here that the government makes, and those are fully CSRA authorized, those are CSRA remedies. Now the second piece of their exhaustion argument is with respect to the challenge to the agency policy by which the agency claims they can pass over well-qualified United States citizens like her for aliens.
1474, okay.
And in connection with that, as you know, there's been an arbitration award that determined in which the agency was fully represented, that rule was illegal and contrary to the authorizing statute. And that determination is now final, and we have pointed out in our submission that is entitled to issue preclusive effect in this forum. And for that reason, then that procedure is, first of all, is facially illegal. And keep in mind,
any examples of the court giving preclusive effect to an arbitral award?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which the plaintiff was not a party?
I'm sorry.
Which the plaintiff was not a party?
We, Your Honor, that, I think, according, first of all, the plaintiff is herself a U.S. citizen, and the class she represents.
Was she a party in the arbitration?
No, she's not, and she could not be. She was not a party.
For whatever reason, so she wants to use this offensively.
Yes, that is correct.
In court.
That's correct.
An arbitral award. Do you have any example of that?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think there's anything remotely unusual about that, in the sense that the argument that the question is, can the government relitigate the issue? And the answer.
The question is whether the court is going to interpret a statute, or perhaps, as you suggest, hold the statute unconstitutional on the ground that an arbitrator said so.
Well, no, Your Honor. First of all, we don't say it was unconstitutional. We say that the agency rule contravened the statute. And that is precisely what the arbitrator determined. That the agency has appealed that to the Federal Labor Relations Authority.
Is the arbitrator purporting to adhere to Chevron?
The arbitrator did. He did, Your Honor. And that decision is now on appeal at FLRA. And that decision, and there's no question that the precedent from this jurisdiction says that the arbitration decision has the status of a district court award, and that it is, and that once the FLRA decides that, that will be the decision of the executive of the United States.
But that is my recollection. This is not yet done, right?
Well, the FLRA, the appeal, frankly, in my estimation, the decision from the FLRA, the award was done after we noted an appeal in this.
No, not the award. The agency is still contesting it.
Well, the agency has appealed it to the FLRA, and a decision from the FLRA has been ripe and overripe for perhaps 4 months.
No, that's not. I understand that you can't do anything about that. But the point is, there is not a final disposition of that with respect to the agency. It's one thing to argue that the agency is bound to go to arbitration, can take its appeal, can have a regulatory posture knocked over in arbitration confirmed by the FLRA, and now it's stuck with it unless it does something. But they had that's not where we are yet.
Well, Your Honor,
the agency's position is still yet to be finally resolved, as I understand it.
Well, Your Honor, we have cited the in this case, the agency has agreed to arbitration of these things, and an arbitral decision has the same status as a district court decision, we've urged, and the restatement and the your point is a matter of what does the appeal do for that. And the law is very clear in the circuit, and we cite it in our brief, that the pendency of an appeal, at least the pendency of an appeal with respect to a district court decision, and I'll acknowledge that may be the difference you're urging, but pendency of appeal does not derogate from the issue preclusive effect of a decision. It's very clear.
What are we supposed to do with our own decision in Gros DDA, which comes out after the arbitral award?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor.
Point.
What's that, Your Honor?
Directly on point. It's adverse to your position, and it comes out after the arbitration.
It did. It was finalized. That's right. In other words, it came out after the arbitration. Correct.
So even if the arbitration would ordinarily be persuasive, here it seems to be inconsistent with circuit law.
Well, Your Honor, but the short answer is Gros Didier did not have the benefit of this. The whole argument here is there a what's the proper forum for this proposition? There's no question this arbitral forum is a proper forum for that decision. Now, the question is, what's the status of it here? And it seems to me, since the VOA elected this forum, they're stuck with that result. And it seems to me, I have to tell you, this may sound too fastidious.
Rusty J. and Nayant remove the concept that there would be a direct APA claim to enforce 1474, right?
That
is what you were seeking.
No, Your Honor, what they did was defer. They were both exhaustion cases, all right, exhaustion decisions. And in this case, and what they said was, that has to be decided in the first instance by some other CSRA forum.
Okay.
Maybe
it'll come to us on review, and maybe not.
That is correct. Well,
this is an on review from that.
This is not on review, and we're urging issue preclusions with respect to that, because it has been decided by a CSRA forum. And a CSRA forum, and the difference between those two cases is there was now a CSRA decision on that very issue. And it says precisely...
What concepts of exhaustion normally mean?
Well, I
that if some body, which we say is supposed to be gone through, has a completely different case addressed it, that suddenly removes the need for exhaustion before raising an APA claim.
Well, keep in mind, if I may, Your Honor, that the plaintiff has raised both discrimination. She's claimed that the practice was discriminatory and facially illegal. Our contention is that just as, for instance, the precedent of this circuit stands for the clear proposition that if an agency, let's say, were to not follow its agency appropriate rules, the prescribed rules for filling a position, that can be considered by the trier of fact as an indicia of discrimination. Likewise...
Your objection is they did follow their rules.
Well, Your Honor, Your Honor, if the agency's position is we never follow the law, we're going to follow an illegal rule, we think that's something that we can, among other things, that we can use as indicia of discrimination. And I might add, Your Honor, we have ample facts of discrimination with respect to this particular complainant, that people misrepresented their rationale for their actions, and the record is rife with those allegations. And there's very strong basis for those.
Am I correct, Mr. Shea, that everything you've said so far presupposes that the plaintiff is an employee?
Not necessarily, and let me distinguish for that, if I may. She has two kinds of complaints here. One is the complaint, and the judge, in my estimation, made factual determinations deciding that she was not an employee. The fact of the matter is she was never an employee. She was never an employee who, within the meaning of, she was never subject to a federal appointment, okay? But she is an employee within the meaning of Title VI, which meant that she could, because of the right of control, the pervasive right of control by the agency for her work environment. She had to sign in. She got her assignments every day from a supervisor. She worked under editors who looked at her work.
Anyone who produces a work product, right, has the customers looking at the work product to see if they regard it as good. I don't think that's what's normally meant in terms of supervision.
Well, Your Honor, she had to sign in. This is an issue of right of control. And when the district court resolved this, the district court looked exclusively at the contract. So that is one and decided in effect that she had no protection from Title VI for purposes of Title VI from the activities that were going on the premises of the federal agency. Now, this is very, very straightforward. People were trying to drive her out of the workplace. It's very simple. They got together to drive her out of the workplace, and the question was, can they do that or not? She had to work.
Maybe there's a tort, but it is accepted that Title VII refers to employees, right?
Your Honor, no, it is not. In fact, in this case, this court found in the Harris case, Harris versus Gonzalez, which dealt with a contractor who was working on the premises of the United States Department of Justice. There was an allegation of sex discrimination by one of the Department of Justice employees that wanted to get rid of this contractor of an employee who worked on the premises. And this court said in Harris, sent the matter back to the district court for trial on the matter of whether this woman had properly exhausted her remedies. And they found that for purposes of that, and the district court proceeded with that, that she was indeed an employee. She did not work for the government of the United States. She worked for a contractor. She worked on the premises of the Department of Justice. And that is precisely what this plaintiff did here. And there...
You seem to be mixing up things. One could be an employee of a contractor of a governmental department. Then one would have Title VII rights against one's employer. Fine. But that, but, But that doesn't enable an independent contractor to have employee rights against the contracting party.
Your Honor, that case, Harris, brought her case against the named defendant in the case was Gonzalez, the Department of Justice. And I might add, there's
relying on what the summary you just gave of it.
No, Your Honor.
It would seem to be that she had a potential claim against her employer. Fine.
Well, no, Your Honor, in this case, the case that this court let move go forward was a case she brought against the United States Department of Justice. And that was under basically a right of control rationale. And here, the right of control was absolutely pervasive. She had to work at night. She worked days and nights. There's statements from her editors who said she did the same work as other federal employees, and that work, I supervised that work in the same manner and fashion as I did for those people. In fact, the occasion that led to her second written complaint was when she was asked to work at night. They said, will you work tonight? She didn't say you work at home. She had to work there. And when she went into work, all these people ganged up and said, basically, we don't want you here in this workplace anymore. And the question is then, and this court has said, and I think there's strong precedent, as long as the employer, in this case the government, has a right of control of the workplace, that she has the rights to complain. Now, there is a second piece of this complaint, which is that has to do with the harassment and the effort to drive her out of the workplace by some colleagues, which management permitted. There is another piece of this case dealing with her non-selections, in which case her status as an employee or not is not necessary, is not essential.
How is that possible?
Well, Your Honor, she applied for a GS-12 position, and the rights...
She's an applicant for...
She is an applicant in that case, Your Honor, and I just want to make sure you understood that was not dependent on her status as an employee or not.
Seems right. Okay. Mr. Shea, you've blown through all your time. We'll give you, 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Jane Lyons from the U.S. Attorney's Office on behalf of the Chairman of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. The heart of this case is really whether the statutory requirements for bringing causes of action are satisfied, and if they are, whether the evidence supports any relief in this case. Mr. Shea has done a wonderful job of entangling many different statutory schemes and concepts, and when they are straightened out...
Is that a compliment?
Pardon me?
Is that a compliment?
I would have to go with no, to be honest. Let me start with, well, I could start in any number of places. How about with would it be helpful to address the difference between the contractor and the employee first?
I have one question about that, and that is, there's this, one of the many prongs of Spirides is integral to the business. And it seemed to me, as I thought about that a translator would be at least more integral to the BBG's business if, say, the translator were producing the Farsi version of statement by the president, something like that, which was then going to be read over the radio, as opposed to a translator who was looking at Iranian documents and under someone's instruction, translating some of them into English so as to guide the formulation of the BBG's programs.
I would agree.
But where does she stand? If that's a correct sort of continuum, where does she stand on it?
I would agree with your overall analysis that it is a continuum, and there are not a lot of cases yet from this circuit that address points in that continuum. I would agree that the translation of material simply from English into Farsi and then handed to the agency to make whatever use of it, the agency is going to have to make decisions about where does it fit in our programming format. Does it go in the 60 minutes-like segment, or is it more, you know, are we going to lead with it? There are a lot of decisions that get made in terms of the presentation of the material once it's taken out of Ms. Aksari's hands and integrated into the agency's mission.
And we know that from the record?
We don't. We have some evidence of the kind of work she did. We know that she translated work English into Farsi and gave it to an editor. That's what the record shows. There's one case that we have, the Alark case that appellant cited in their brief, as a video editor at BBG. And there the court seemed to find that, and it was the district court, that that was more integral to the mission of the BBG's.
And I'm sorry, it was what exactly?
More integral.
No, but what was the, what made it more integral?
The video editing, the sort of the being more integrally related
to
the process,
closer
to the end product, if you will. Whereas in Zenzing, this court summarily affirmed a district court finding that a translator for the Chinese service, Mandarin service, this court summarily affirmed the district court's finding using the Spiriti's factors that the translator was an independent contractor. And here, the evidence, one thing Mr. Shea said up here was that the district court looked only at the contract in making its decision. That's not the case at all. There's abundant evidence in the record addressing the Spiriti's factors. Things like, I'll point the court to both JA50 and JA72 are two of the best pages to look at. The kind of occupation is specialized. It's done without much supervision. Ms. Aksari testified in her deposition that as a POV, we are considered independent workers. We should not be closely supervised because we come as experts. That's out of her own mouth. The skill required is obviously a very high level. Farsi is not a common language in the American population, as far as I know. The method of payment, she was paid by the job. And actually, that's an important point with regard to distinguishing the Harris case that Mr. Shea addressed. In Harris versus DOJ, the employee who was an employee of the Executive Office of United States Attorneys, a security personnel specialist, she was paid a salary. And that's a very big distinction because Spiriti's says that the economic realities of the work relationship are what's important to look at, but that you also have to look at all of the factors. So being paid by the job here is a big distinction, and Ms. Aksari was paid by
Harris
the job.
Harris is a straight classification of a person as an employee. It doesn't create, as Shea led me to believe, some kind of privity between the employee of an independent contractor and the government which hires the independent contractor.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. Here there's no government contractor. It's just between the agency and the person. She did not accrue annual leave. She didn't participate in the federal retirement systems. The agency did not pay her Social Security taxes. And the intention of the parties was clear at all times. Ms. Aksari testified clearly in her deposition that she understood she wasn't an employee. So for all those reasons, it's clear here that she is a contractor. She does not, therefore, enjoy rights under Title VII.
So what you're saying is even if we found that the arbitration award had preclusive effect, she could not benefit from it because of her lack of employment status?
I'm not going to say she can't benefit from it. What I'm saying is she can't benefit from in this lawsuit through this vehicle because there are several reasons. One is she's never been a member of the union that brought that arbitration. The biggest reason, of course, is that, and the court's already focused on this, I think, the award is not final. The award right now
is
except
there is case law that says if there's no stay, it has binding effect. The FLRA didn't stay this award.
No,
as I understand it, they didn't.
The FLRA hasn't. There's really no action to stay at the moment. The FLRA.
Sure you can ask the FLRA to stay the application of the award. There's a case in the circuit in the mid-80s which said that was the FLRA rule, that the arbitration award is binding on the agency unless it's stayed, even though they might overturn it later. And I don't know whether that's been changed. I can't find anything to suggest that it's different now.
And I'm not suggesting that it is. What I am suggesting here is that the opinion of the arbitrator is mostly retrospective in terms of what's going to happen. The correct route for Ms. Coxari to have raised a complaint about non-citizenship would have been to go to the Office of Special Counsel first, then to the Merit Systems Protection Board, and then to the Federal Circuit. And that's the route for her.
Well, are you saying, you're saying we can avoid the whole question about arbitration because she did not exhaust her CSRA?
I'm saying she did not exhaust her CSRA claim, so that is why she cannot bring this non-citizen claim. There's also Gross Didier and Neont. She just, it's jurisdictionally barred in this court.
Your answer is yes to Judge Edwards' question.
Yes, yes and yes twice or squared. One other point I would like to make is that Mr. Shea represented to you that the arbitrator did not apply Chevron 2 deference to the agency's interpretation, but the arbitrator, in fact, found that the statute as written was not ambiguous, so he didn't reach the question of whether or not he was going to defer to the agency's interpretation. That's just a correction of what was said. I don't think it matters. The pendency of it before the FLRA and the availability of judicial review and Ms. Coxari being completely unconnected to it or what prevent that from making any impact on this case. Let's see. So without finding that she is an employee, which on this record I would submit is impossible, we don't need to address the harassment claims to drive her out of the workplace. Mr. Shea, during his last seconds, mentioned the non-selections, and I'd like to briefly address the exhaustion issue because I wasn't terribly satisfied with my own presentation in the brief. The GS-12 international broadcaster position, the selection was made in July, and she was notified by a letter. And the complaint that he relies upon to say that he exhausted that claim is from January of the same year, before the selection was made. It's hard to exhaust something that hasn't happened yet. And under, of course, National Passenger Railroad versus Morgan, all of these, to be timely, exhaustion has to be within 45 days of the thing that you're complaining about. And so for that reason, the exhaustion argument is basically that she didn't complain in a timely fashion to preserve a Title VII claim with regard to the GS-12 selection.
What do you say she had to do precisely to exhaust under CSRA, your view?
I would say that she had to first go to the Office of Special Counsel, and then if she were unsatisfied with what happened with the Office of Special Counsel, she could file an individual claim with the Merit Systems Protection Board. The Office of Special Counsel also can sort of step in as a prosecutor at that point and try to get the agency to change its ways. And then at that point, review goes to the Federal Circuit first. And under United States versus Fausto, that's sort of that system has been recognized as the primary means of federal employees bringing such grievances into courts.
Now, again, there's so many different facets to this thing. To what extent are you arguing that to the extent that her claims are based on citizenship discrimination, that ends the causes of action under what, Title VII, ADA, in 1981? Is that what you're saying? Because they're not covered?
Those statements are all certainly true. Yes, you're
right. I'm just trying to understand where are you pitching your case? Are you saying this is a claim of discrimination based on citizenship? There is no such claim under Title VII, ADA, in 1981?
That's correct.
Exhaustion or what? What's the largest umbrella defense that you're presenting? The employee, the non-citizenship, the timeliness, the what?
Well, as an applicant for employment, she's clearly covered under Title VII and the ADEA
right.
for non-selections.
Right.
within that universe, I think of them as alternative arguments, failure to exhaust.
The applicant claim on the failure to exhaust?
She doesn't complain about, well, she does. She complains about, but Title VII doesn't cover discrimination, so that claim fails because it's not a covered
citizenship.
I'm sorry. Citizenship. Thank you, Judge Williams.
That's what I'm trying to understand. So that would cover the applicant claim. You're saying her claim of discrimination, even as to application, is citizenship?
Yes. Primarily. She mentions other claims. She alleges them.
All right, let's assume there's something else there that would be cognizable under Title VII for applicant. And what is your response then?
I have several responses to that. First, for the GS-12 position that Mr. Shea mentioned, that she didn't properly exhaust it because she didn't file an EEO complaint within 45 days of being notified that she had not been picked. We also have evidence from the Director of Human Resources that she was ranked fifth. Remember, this is the, I should back up, this is the announcement for which no selection was made. The agency canceled this particular announcement and reposted it with a different requirement that applicants submit on-air samples of their work or published works. Even if a selection had been made, the Human Resources Director has given unrebutted evidence that Ms. Coxari ranked fifth on the certificate of eligibles, and someone from the top three had to be picked, so she wouldn't have been picked anyway. So you can pick lack of coverage under Title VII, or if there is coverage under Title VII or the ADEA, failure to exhaust, and even if exhausted, then the evidence shows there's no way to draw a reasonable inference that any prohibited factor played any role in the decision to cancel the thing, and nobody got picked. Does that help?
I just want to make sure I understand the party's positions. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we would respectfully ask that the district court's judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lyons.
Your Honors, let me be heard briefly on a couple of items. One, if the issue as to what activities Ms. Coxari was performing, she not only did translation, but she did voicing. And the supplementary record at page 2 describes the work she did, which includes the fact that she did translations and voicing radio programs in Farsi language in the Persian service and in the Persian News Network. And I might add at page A228 of the record, there is a letter from her supervisor, the person who, Sheila Ganji, she wrote to a letter in which she set out, Ms. Coxari, she's in this capacity, Ms. Coxari utilized her skills to write and translate stories from English to Farsi for broadcast and for broadcast on VOA through its internet site. She also voiced material on air from time to time. She was not only a translator. With respect to the more sort of the legal proposition, if I may, as to whether the distinction, if any, between the decision in Harris and here, it, to the extent that Harris did in fact work, there was an intermediate employer in the sense that Harris worked for some contractor.
We didn't address the employee independent contractor issue, did we?
You mean in the...
In our opinion.
In Harris? It is stated that she worked for a contractor. I don't remember, frankly, whether that contractor was identified. And I think the allegation was
it's not an analysis. Our opinion is not an analysis of what makes an employee as opposed to an independent contractor, right?
The value of that decision, and there are district court decisions that relate to VOA, but the Harris is a circuit court decision, but it's very clear that Harris did not work for the Department of Justice. Remember, she worked at the Department of Justice for another employer, and that the allegation was
the employer was the United States government agency, so it was under Title VII, right?
No. She was not paid by Department of Justice. She was paid by a contractor, and they were working at the Department of Justice.
In any event, our court doesn't address the question of employee versus independent contractor there, right?
No, they did. What they did address was primarily a question of notice in that decision.
Okay.
The question
is how much... So our opinion is not pertinent in that case, to this case.
Well, I would gently disagree, Your Honor, because that decision would have been entirely superfluous if the court could have disposed of it on the proposition
that what issues were raised by the parties.
Well, that was not something that was sort of sub rosa or somewhere off to the side.
Sometimes issues are not sub rosa, but they're still not put before.
If I may say, Your Honor, that was the centerpiece of the decision, it seemed to me, that she was not a direct employee. And the question there was, What notice did she have? Did she understand, you know, failure to exhaust is an affirmative defense. What, and the question was, what did understanding should she have had as to the notices that were posted about the 45-day exhaustion requirement? So it seems to me that was almost unavoidable, if I may gently say.
You said earlier in your first appearance that the district judge made certain findings of fact, inappropriately made findings of fact.
Well, with respect to the contractor decision, I think that the judge relied primarily on the contract and did not focus on the indicia that the circuit has mandated in Spreedes, which is the right of control. The right of control, we suggested, were things like that she was required to work in that, in the building, that all the facilities were there, were that she had to sign in and sign out, that she got her assignments on a daily basis.
But you're not disputing, are you, that she had to, I mean, no one's disputing some of any of the facts you just recounted.
No, nobody's disputing those.
So there's not you don't need a trial on any of that. You want a reversal on the law.
Well, I think, first of all, I want a reversal on the law, but at a minimum, it seemed to me the judge should have had to have submitted that. That could have been submitted to a trier of fact, at a minimum. But I think the judge erred.
I'm not sure which of your two statements I should remember when we leave here. Was it?
Then I don't.
Is it that on the facts that the judge had before him, you should have prevailed?
Yes.
Okay. And alternatively, that there was a material dispute on which you should get a trial?
Correct.
And what's the material dispute?
Material dispute.
As to whether there was control,
It's not a fact issue, is it? I mean, that's a conclusion to be drawn from all the facts.
That's a conclusion drawn from the facts.
Well, the judge is going to draw the conclusion at the end of the proceeding, or the jury is, but the point is that that's not a factual dispute.
The indicia that I've just described are not in dispute.
Okay. All right. You're through your rebuttal time. You have a parting thought you'd like to leave?
Well, Your Honor, I just want to make sure that there were three non-selections that were at issue in this case, and I don't think there's any dispute about the timeliness of what plaintiff did for the first of the. There is for the third of those, but for the first two, there's no issue about the timeliness of her exhaustion. That is, for the GS-12 position that I discussed, which was when she submitted a memo dated January 12, 2000.
Research coordinator.
The research coordinator position, that was certainly timely. Nobody disputes that, I don't think. And nothing happened.
She
nothing.
Had to be an employee.
No, not for that one in particular. That actually raised two issues. That raised a non-selection issue, and it referenced the harassment issue. And then her second one, which was dated, I think March 28th or 9th, as I recall, that one focused primarily on the in-office harassment issue.
That's harassment based on what? Citizenship?
Well, Your Honor, that's what the district court required, I think. The district court said you have to tell me what that's based on.
Right.
And she, in her position was that, frankly, I don't know that I have to, these were a collection of people whose explicit objective was to drive her out of the workplace.
Yeah, but if their objective is not
going to be a cause of action somewhere, there's lots of mean things that go on in workplaces that we don't have any jurisdiction to consider.
But first of all, the answer is that's not. I don't think that could be possibly be a matter of jurisdiction in the sense that she said. First of all, she's a woman.
Jurisdiction in the sense that we have to have subject matter jurisdiction somewhere, and if there's no statute that covers. That, you know, the person didn't smile at me, and you file a complaint and say, no, but I really felt terribly for months.
First of all, Your Honor, that
is... You can't get into court on that.
There are really two different things here, and this, I think, is very fundamental. I'm glad you raised it, and that is, the question was her termination retaliatory? And if...
Based on what?
And, well, she complains at length, and I think the question is, what is that, is the... Let's say
for the termination, she has to be an employee, right?
I mean, we're prescinding from that, Judge, for the moment, okay? But assuming she
retaliation, if it's retaliation for filing an EEO complaint, that's one thing, right? But I'm still trying to understand what it is your harassment is a good starting point for me. I was harassed for what reason?
She's an older woman. She's a woman older. These are basically younger alien employees who want to drive her out.
I'm not minimizing the nastiness of it, counsel. I'm just trying to understand the cause of action. Is the complaint as presented about citizenship, or is it about age,
sex? She's over 50. These are basically a group of young employees who want to get rid of her.
So you think the answer is, with respect to those matters, that on discrimination, on harassment, the charge that she is making is about sex and age?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just trying to understand what your theory is. Because if it's citizenship, then it
should be heard. And I don't think the court properly can or should need or needs to do an analysis of what is the particular motivation of a particular person. It seems to me in ACCA, for instance, this the precedent in a standard Title VII case, prescinding from this issue about whether she's an employee. Same Title VII case, the court would say, look, if there was a material misrepresentation about what went on, okay, then the court, then a trier of fact could conclude it was discriminatory. Here, I don't think you have to, and the district court, I think, required some sort of an analysis of what the...
I'm asking, when you say discriminatory, that presupposes something. It's discriminatory as to what?
The answer is sex and age.
Okay. That's what I'm trying to understand.
Thank you, Mr. Shea.
Thank you.
Ms. Lyons, thank you. I trust there are no more prongs. Ms. Fork. Okay. Thank you both. Case is submitted.